From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Dale Thronberry.
And good morning, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, and I have the honor and privilege of being your host today. And we're going to be talking about the Korean War this morning. Our guest is going to be Kenneth Eaton, whose book is called Missing Dog Tags. He was a POW in North Korea for almost 30 months, and he's going to be on after the first break. And we're going to talk a little bit about the Korean War, which we know, of course, is the forgotten war. Many people don't even remember what was going on 60 years ago. And so we want to do that. First of all, I want to thank everybody for contacting us here at Veterans Radio and asking about my partner, Bob Gould. He is recovering. I talked with him just the other day, and he's hoping to be back in a couple of weeks. He had some surgery done on his head, and we all know it. I'll keep that joke to myself this week. And but he's doing better, and so we're hoping that he can get back here pretty quickly. And again, thank you for the cards and emails and so forth. We're very excited to hear from you anytime. If you have a story idea that you'd like us to use, coming up in January, we're going to be talking to a World War II veteran that someone referred to us from Naples, Florida, so I'm excited about that. Coming up, actually, in the next couple of weeks, next week, if you have a gift for veterans or you know somebody who manufactures military gear or anything, we're going to be talking about Christmas gifts for veterans. So if you can get them to contact me at Dale at Veterans Radio, we will try to get them on the program next week to talk a little bit about their products. In the past, we've had authors on to talk about their books. We've had military gear manufacturers, you know, bomber jackets, license plates, bracelets, fatigues, so on and so forth. We've had people that have done artwork. So this is their opportunity to promote their product, free advertising. All we ask is that you contact us, and we'll try to get you on the air for a couple of minutes to talk about that product. Some other things that are going on, of course, as we approach the Christmas season are many, many organizations are helping out at the local veterans hospitals, and we would like to promote those if we can. So send me an email, dale@veteransradio.net, and I will try to get that information out on the air so that we can let people know what you're up to. I know locally here in the Ann Arbor area, the community college is collecting funds and gifts for the local VA hospital, and I think that's kind of cool. And so it's always interesting when you hear about these civilian groups that are helping out with veterans at this time of year. I want to also make sure that you are aware of some of the upcoming programs. As I mentioned, next week is the Gifts for Veterans. On the following week, the 22nd, we're going to take a look at the USO, United Service Organization, and the Bob Hope type of organization for those of us our age that will remember that. But they're still very, very active, and in fact, they're in Afghanistan and Iraq today. Some of their entertainers are over there helping out, and they provide supplies and entertainment for our troops here and abroad. There are also many airports around the country where veterans can go and relax. And we're going to talk about the history of that coming up on the 22nd, I believe it is. We're going to take our first break right now, come back and talk about the Korean War with our guest, Kenneth Eaton. And also, I want to remind you, if you have some questions for us or for our guests, give us a call here at Veterans Radio. That's 877-573-7825. And we'll be right back after this.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now, we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Mr. Santa, bring me a dream. Make him the king.
And we are back on Veterans Radio, and it was kind of difficult finding music from the 1950s. Many of us remembered them, but we couldn't remember who actually sang the songs and so forth. So I want to appreciate our crew today of Nina and Maria for helping me put together a quick CD of music from the 1950s. And we wanted to do that because we're going to be talking about Korea this morning here on Veterans Radio. And I want to give you just a quick little background on the Korean War. And I'm taking this from the history.com. It says, on June 25th, 1950, the Korean War began when some 75,000 soldiers from the North Korean People's Army poured across the 38th parallel, the boundary between the Soviet-backed Democratic People's Republic of Korea to the north and the pro-Western Republic of Korea to the south. This invasion was the first military action of the Cold War. By July of 1950, American troops had entered the war on South Korea's behalf. As far as American officials were concerned, it was a war against the forces of international communism itself. After some early back and forth across the 38th parallel, the fighting stalled and casualties mounted with nothing to show for them. Meanwhile, American officials worked anxiously to fashion some sort of armistice with the North Koreans. The alternative they feared would be a wider war with Russia and China, and even as some warned, World War III. Finally, in July of 1953, the Korean War came to an end. In all, some 5 million soldiers and civilians lost their lives during that war. And the Korean Peninsula is still divided today. That's just a brief background. We're going to learn a lot more about it today with our guest, Kenneth Eaton. And Ken was captured three times by the North Koreans, and unfortunately, and he escaped three times. So it's going to be kind of an interesting story. His book is Missing Dog Tags, an American GI in North Korea. And I want to welcome Ken Eaton to Veterans Radio. Welcome, Ken.
Thank you. Thank you, Dale.
It was such a pleasure to read your book, and I want to thank you for getting those memories out, because that's one of the things that we try to do on Veterans Radio, is to get these stories out by the people that actually participated in them. And this is a wonderful story. It's called Missing Dog Tags. It's by the Patience Press, and it's just it was a good read. I was one of those things where I had stayed up all night to finish it. Can I ask you when did you get into the Army? When did you join up?
Well, I went in 1946. I didn't turn 18 until November of 46, and my father had a peach orchard, a farm, in a town called Sanger up by Fresno, California, and he needed the help there. So and I had an older brother in the service all during the Second World War, and when he got discharged in 45, he's telling me the stories, and I excited. You know, a young guy, I was 18 years old. Well, I was 17 years old, and when I turned 18, I joined. And I was 8 weeks basic training, and they sent me to Tokyo, in the Tokyo area. And I was there during the occupational force for 25 months before the Korean War.
And tell me what your MOS was. What were your duties when you got to Korea?
Well, I was armor. And there, because it was peacetime army, I was assigned to a reconnaissance organization that was, he made armored cars with rubber tires, mounted a 37 millimeter on an open turret and a couple of 30 caliber machine guns in the front end. And it was basically a riot vehicle, but it was reconnaissance. And what we did there, when we had the Korean uprisings, because there was a lot of communists in Japan at the time, too. And on May Day, it was a big deal that we, four of our armored cars, we'd be sent down to a town between the Camp Drake, the base I was in, and Tokyo, and drive around them and try to corral them and quiet them down and get them, disperse them, and that's what I did, really. And other than that, it was a peacetime army, and most everyone played sports.
Played sports, huh?
Yeah.
You did some boxing, didn't you?
That was the sport I played there. It kept me from choking up Mount Fuji, which was, if you had to go on bivouac, it was Mount Fuji, full pack, and gear, and it was a tough haul. I did it a couple of times, and once I started boxing, I no longer had to do that, and I liked that. And I, in fact, as I was assigned to a special service barracks, I made the 1st Cav Division boxing team, and we went around all over Japan and boxed different divisions, the 25th, the 24th, and the different cavalry regiments, and like they did too, and to entertain the troops. It was, and the football was played, basketball was played, baseball was played, and it was a peacetime army. We weren't training like maybe we should have been.
Mm-hmm. Well, what happened, we're talking with Ken Eaton, the author of a book called Missing Dog Tags, about his experiences in North Korea. If you have a question for Ken at some point during our interview, give us a call here at 877-573-7825. Ken, tell me, when you were sent to Korea, did you have any idea what you were getting into?
No, I didn't. In fact, most of my outfit was sent about the end of June, and the company commander kept just a small skeleton force in I was in Osaka. They had moved me down to Osaka, the outfit, and most of those guys in about 2 weeks were killed. And the M8 armored cars didn't last very long. That was sent over. It was called a police action at that time. Mm-hmm. And what they ran up against was T-34 tanks, the tanks that the Russians used to turn the Tiger tank around when the Germans tried to take over Moscow. The North Koreans had 500 of them, and it was a heck of a battle, and because we weren't prepared with the type of vehicle that it took to repel that kind of an attack for some months. And I was in the Busan perimeter. Everyone was shoved down to the Busan and trying to defend herself. And the Nakton River came in from the east and turned around and curved south. And that was our last border of defense. And in fact, it's General Walker, who was in charge of the combat there at that particular time, orders came out because we were losing so badly that fight or die, because we can't go any further south. And so that went on until General MacArthur did the Incheon landing, which was on the west coast, and came in with the 1st Marines and I think the 7th Army, and broke their supply and turned them around and allowed us to break out of the Busan perimeter. And then, of course, we chased them all the way to the Yalu River, the North Koreans, and defeated them, actually. I was within 50 miles of the Yalu when the Chinese hit. Of course, that's what turned the war around and made the stalemate out of it, because they come in with close to 300,000 soldiers, and we maybe had 25 or 30,000 at that time, nice, scattered up in North Korea near the Yalu River. And we got orders to fight a withdrawal, and we did that in stages until I was south of the 38th parallel, 50 miles, with my outfit when I got captured. I was in a town called Hongsong, which later became known as Massacre Valley because of so many of us were killed there.
Well, I want to go to that time of when you were captured, but also for our audience's sake, when the war began in Korea, we were kind of on a holding action. They just wanted to push the North Koreans back to the 38th parallel. They didn't necessarily want to keep on going. But then General MacArthur was able to convince them that we needed to make it more of an offensive war instead of a defensive war. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And then, so then you guys pushed the North Koreans not only back to, north of the 38th parallel, I think you almost pushed them into China, which got them all upset. And then they sided with the North Koreans and brought in those 300,000 troops to your, 30,000?
Yeah, we had approximately. I can only estimate that because of the information I've picked up, because I was, of course, fighting with the 2nd Division, and I, in the meantime, had been transferred to there, and I was in heavy tanks. and M26s, which is mounted a 90-millimeter tank, 90-millimeter gun, which gave us the ability to defeat the T-34 because it was at least equal to it.
So what happened then back in early February of 1951?
Well, I was my platoon of tanks was assigned to a South Korean regiment that was having trouble with Chinese cavalry in a valley called Hongsong Valley, and they couldn't do anything with them. And our artillery that we had I think five positions set up, the 503rd, and they couldn't get shots into the Chinese. Because the end of the valley dropped off so fast, so they assigned our tanks near it and up to the front, so that when we had the opportunity, we could shoot their head off, and we were having real good luck. I'd only been there 3 days when February the 11th came around, and we were overrun and had to withdraw back in the valley. And what had happened, there'd been a low overcast ceiling, and our liaison planes couldn't come in and help watch what was going on. The Chinese, there were so many divisions there, they moved around us even in the daytime and blocked the end of the valley so we couldn't get out. And when we tried to run the roadblock and destroy what was there stopping our retreat, there was our first tank got out and radioed back and said we're about a mile back going out in intervals, radioed back and said it's okay, you can do it. And the platoon leader, which is a lieutenant who controlled the platoon, was in the fourth tank, and so he advised or ordered the second tank to go, and firing happened again, and a lot of noise, and more than it did the first time. Apparently, they had decided they'd reinforced what they had, the Chinese had there, because they weren't stopping the tanks. And the second tank never ever radioed back. So after about 10 or 15 minutes, the lieutenant, I was in the third tank, and my tank commander was named Rose, and gave him orders to go, and so we made a run for it. And every time any of our tanks would pull out, we would load up with infantry. We had K Company of the 9th Regiment there with us, and we would load up infantry to take with us to help get them out, too, riding. Well, they were getting shot off the tanks.
Oh,
no,
cool.
No one knew what was going on down there. You know, it was dark in the snow, and even their captain, Captain Jones, was on my tank, hiding behind the turret, trying to fight at the same time and get protection, you know. But anyway, we made a run for it, too, and took a 3.5 bazooka in the side. We were hit twice, and the first time it didn't break through into the tank, and the second time it come through inside and exploded and blew the tank commander out of the top of the turret, or burned him real bad and he clumb out. I don't know how he got out.
Mm-hmm.
But the driver got shot in the head, and the loader had tried to drive the tank and it wouldn't work. So we ultimately, with a huge fire over our ammo on the center of the deck inside the tank, there was nobody for me to talk to. I had no choice but to throw my hatch open. I was a ball gunner up in the front on the right-hand side of the tank, just to throw my hatch open and try to dive out the front of the tank. And, of course, it was just like suicide because the tank was being hit like hell on a tin roof, you know, from all the automatic fire where we were located. We'd slid to a stop about 5 feet behind the second tank where it was knocked out.
Mm-hmm.
It hadn't got through. And I got out of the front of the tank and crawled around to a slope on the right-hand side of the tank opposite where the automatic fire was coming in, and just had enough room to get my body behind this little slope with shells just turning the snow up just to my left of my body. I could smell the powder. It was so much ammo coming in until the firing died down a little bit, and I could hear Chinese talking. And walking in the snow, there was wounded everywhere, from the K Company and from South Koreans and from our artillery people that had been trying to get out. And there were wounded and dead guys everywhere. And my thinking was, before this, I heard the Chinese walking in the snow. The lieutenant came out with his tank, and I tried to board it, but get on it too. And he got out of his tank and was pulling the dead and wounded out of the way. So he came around on our side of the tank, get a little shelter from the automatic fire. And I jumped up and tried to get on this tank, and he told me to get on. But by then, he was climbing up the only decent spot you can get on the tank, and he had already given them the order to hit it. And so I had to go crawl back to where I'd been. That's when I heard the Chinese walking in the snow after the automatic fire died down about 10 or 15 minutes later. And I looked up, and there was a Chinaman standing over me with a German machine pistol. I'll never forget what it looked like. He motioned for me to get up and follow him. Well, they're shooting wounded, and maybe even reshooting dead, you know. So I readily got up and walked by. I couldn't figure out what was going to happen. Death, of course, because the North Koreans always kill their prisoners. You know, they just didn't take any. And this is what I expected to happen to me. But I had no gun when I got out, dove out the front of my tank. My .45 had fallen out of my holster, and I didn't know it. And when I went for a gun, there wasn't no gun to be had.
Oh.
And so I was captured at that time, and in 10 or 15 minutes, there was about six or eight of us standing in the middle of this dirt road, and no Chinese guards standing around us. But there was hundreds scattered all around the area, you know, within 25 to 50 feet, and walking around through the dead, and they were actually looting. They were taking boots and any warmer clothing.
Goodness, what was going through your mind? We're talking with Kenneth Eaton here, the author of a book entitled Missing Dog Tags, about his experiences being captured as a POW in Korea. And you can give us a call here at Veterans Radio at 877-573-7825. You are standing in the snow, and you've got bad guys all around you, but they didn't seem to be guarding you very closely.
No, well, the reason for that was there was hundreds of them milling around. You know, they were all over the place because there was still fighting going on. There were still South Koreans trying to break out, and a few Americans that hadn't made a rush for it like we had tried to do to knock out the roadblock. There were still a few Americans trying to get out. The 503rd artillery, there was three or four positions of 105s there, and each one of those have about 30 guys. So there was maybe a 100 artillery men trying to get out, and there was dead ones laying around us too. There was the place was just covered up with bodies, you know. And on the opposite side of our tanks that were knocked out were a lot of Chinese, because when we came down through there, we're shooting machine guns all into the masses, you know. Mm-hmm. And so there were Chinese all over that side of the opposite side from the tank. So, but you know, they're really funny. Unlike Americans, I got the sensation from them over the period of several years that there's no actual hot anger when you shoot, when they see some of theirs fall, like it is Americans.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know why that is. It's just a different mentality, you know. It's part of their job, and they're going to do it, and they're not mad, you know, mm-hmm. Seems like. This officer that I'm assuming was an officer that had me standing in the road, well, then, like I said, the three or four or five, maybe six, were gathered there in about 15, 10 or 15 minutes. They're going around finding soldiers like me that either are wounded and you can get up and walk, or you're not wounded at all. And so ultimately, there was about 50 of us, and they moved us in a draw about 200 yards east of the position we were in to get us out of the fighting and to control us. because there were still more South Koreans trying to come from about 2 miles, 2.5 miles or 3 miles up the valley, trying to fight their way down and get out. Mm-hmm. And so because they wanted to confront them without our being involved and had to guard us, they moved us away. Fortunately, I stayed there all that night and the next day and watched our airplanes. I guess we had some P-51s and I think three jets or two or three F-80s come in and strafe all of the equipment because they must have got orders that the friendlies, which is Americans, were either dead or gone, and they didn't want the Chinese to be able to take over our equipment, so they strafed them for about 20 or 30 minutes the next day after daylight when the ceiling raised, and we were about 200 yards away watching the up a little higher than the valley floor, so as the planes would come down, you could almost see the pilot from the distance we were at. We thought we could anyway, but there was about 65 or 70 of us, and officers and enlisted men, and we had an interpreter there, and they passed out all kinds of propaganda literature with pictures of Chairman Mao Zedong on it, and then broken English. Their use of the American language was kind of like Charlie McCarthy used to talk on the radio or on television. You know, at least we thought they were all a bunch of Charlie McCarthy's at that time.
Charlie McCarthy, for our younger audiences, was a dummy, part of the Ventriloquist Act.
Yes.
With what's the guy's name? Bergen. That's right. Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy.
Yes,
that's what it was.
Yes. I'm sorry. I should have explained that. Maybe
no. That's all right. That's okay. That's my job. I'm supposed to be doing that. We got about 3 minutes before we take a break at the bottom of the hour. We're talking with Kenneth Eaton, who's author of Missing Dog Tags, about his experiences being captured as a POW. And right at this time, you are now starting off on what you call in your book is a death march.
A death march. The following night, we stayed there that day after the strafings until dark. And then we found out they're going to walk us every night, 15 to 25 miles, and then they're going to hide us every day in a village if they can find one, an empty village. Well, most of the North Koreans in that area, because of the fighting to and fro with the North Korean army, had become refugees and were moving south. So many of the villages had very few people in them, and so they would move us into villages, empty villages, into rooms. And every house over there, the largest house I ever seen, only had three rooms, two bedrooms and a kitchen, which is just a lower, everything's made out of clay or mud and rocks, the walls are, with rice straw roofs. And Mama's son cooks in the lower level, with a pot made into a bench of mud, and the floors are built on, the mud floors are built on stacked rocks, which allows tunnels all underneath the floors. And on the outside of the house, there will be a place for Papa Son to build a fire, and on the opposite side, there's a stack made out of wood that's a flue that allows the smoke and heat to pass underneath the floor and go out the downward wind side of the house, which heats the floor. It's out of the,
pretty ingenious.
Yeah, and it works. It does work, you know. And the better built houses are, seems like the ones that was taken care of, has a rice straw matting over the floor. But when we went through them, everything was worn out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we lived in those things by the day, and walked every night, and starvation started. And there ultimately was like 65 or 70 of us, and then in a matter of maybe 2 weeks or three, there was 200 or 300, and because they'd come down in such masses all along all up and down the line, that they continually added 100 or 50 or 25 prisoners to the group until within probably 4 or 5 weeks there was 700 or 800 of us.
Wow. I'm gonna cut you off here for just a second, Ken. We're gonna be taking a break here at the bottom of the hour. You're listening to Veterans Radio, and our guest is Kenneth Eaton. We'll be right back after this.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Private First Class Melvin Brown, out of ammunition, used his entrenching tool to defend his position. Details after this.
There's always a moment of truth where I say, look, it's either put up or shut up. And it was time to put up. I had crossed that thin line. It was 100 plus degrees. We were hot. We were on fire. We were yelling our hearts out. You could feel the intensity rising. Even in our tiredness, even in our weakness, even in our pain, we continued to push. I told myself, you can suck up the pain for another mile and a half, and you will be a Marine. Not many people believe that I could do it. I don't know where I got the energy from. I don't know where the pain went to. But all I know is that I had what it took. I am a United States Marine.
AFC Darrell Willis proved he could be one of us. Can you? Call 1-800-MARINES. Maybe you could be one of the few and the proud.
While his platoon was securing Hill 755, the North Koreans counterattacked. Taking a position on a 50-foot-high wall, Brown delivered heavy rifle fire on the enemy. His ammunition was soon expended, and although wounded, he remained at his post and threw his few grenades. When his supply of grenades was exhausted, his comrades from nearby foxholes tossed others to him, and he left his position, braving a hail of fire, to retrieve and throw them at the enemy. The attackers continued their assault, and Brown, weaponless, drew his entrenching tool from his pack and calmly waited until they peered over the wall, delivering each a crushing blow on the head. Brown's daring action so inspired his platoon that they repelled the attack and held their position. Brown was reported killed in action September 5, 1950. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
If I could take you up in paradise up above, if you would tell me I'm the only one that you love, life could be free.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we're talking with Kenneth Eaton about his experiences as a POW in Korea during the 1950s, and that's why we're playing some of that music that we can find. I don't know if you would recognize that, Ken, or not.
Yes, I do, and I love it.
That's on a light note, but getting back to your book, you are on this death march, and I was just reading ahead during the break, and the weather is freezing. And we've heard stories about the weather in Korea, and you guys weren't really prepared for all that cold weather.
No, the winter of 51 was the most severe winter that I endured while I was there, and it killed a lot of guys in our condition, because we were caught without winter clothing when we were. They were just starting to issue winter clothing, and when the Chinese hit, and of course we're fighting a withdrawal in stages, and our supply didn't have a chance to get to anybody on the line, and very few men did I ever see on the death march or in the rear camps had any winter clothing at all. You know.
Well, I was just reading. There's a really gut wrenching description here of somebody who has frostbite and their toes have turned black, and the North Korean or Chinese medic just comes in and basically, excuse me, folks, you know, starts pulling them off with pliers.
Yeah, I was in an apple cellar in one of the stages where they held us over, and our planes had been strafing the village. Mm-hmm. So the first chance someone had got outside and they'd seen them, or they'd seen a Russian truck parked with supplies or something, but the planes had worked on it for maybe 30 minutes, and when they left, the Chinese knew that they were coming back, so they moved as many of us as they could into, I guess, several apple cellars. I never knew there was even any apples there, you know, in the Korea, but well, that's what we went down about with about 3 feet of logs and dirt over the top, and then a room maybe 30 feet wide and 30 or 40 feet long with not tables, but places to store stuff in the mm-hmm. center where guys could sit down along the walls and underneath it and up on top of it. And there was probably 300 in the room I was in, or 250 or 300. And the smell, and I had thought by then most of the wounded had already died, you know, because we had no medical. But the smell got, you knew there was something going on in there, you know. Mm-hmm. And Chinese interpreter come and said that there was a doctor, but he wasn't a doctor. He was just a soldier. He had some colored cloth and some looked like watered down iodine, and they wanted the wounded to come forward. And when I went into this apple cellar, was sitting just slightly to the left of the entrance on the floor. And so I witnessed what went on. We had guys with frozen feet, frozen hands, and some wounded still, but walking wounded that was surviving, that came forward to be helped. But the first thing I seen was men take off their boots, and their feet was either black to the up to the arch or up past the ankle. I don't know how they were walking on them, except they couldn't feel the pain, I guess, at least in that part that was dead, but below a gangrene was sitting in. And they broke off toes and feet. And
I'm sorry to even have to ask you to even talk about that. Let's talk about your first escape. How did you get away?
Well, my tank commander, who had got burned when the explosion came inside the tank, had escaped. I seen him that night before capture, and then when they captured us after the lieutenant's tank left, I suspected maybe he got on the tank somehow, because I never seen him again. And he'd been lying in the ditch. I was behind about 30 feet in front of me, hiding behind the other side of it, trying to get protection from the automatic fire. So I run into him about maybe 3 weeks later, or I have no idea the time it went by, 3 or 4 weeks, and he'd escaped or been out for 7 or 8 or 9 days. And when I ran into him, and I couldn't believe it, and his head was a lot better shape, and his shoulders where he'd been burned, and he explained to me that he'd been trying to get back through our lines, but he'd go to Korean villages where there weren't any Chinese and North Koreans, and just old mama sons and papa sons, and he'd beg food, and they'd feed him. And he says, actually, what's happening to us, because we were getting fed about every 3 or 4 days if we got anything at all, and then there's a handful of this chicken feed that they boil in just water and nothing with it, you know. And it was called sorghum cane seed that is a little larger than rice. They don't grow rice in North Korea of any consequence. It's too poor of a country. It's all rocky, and there's no rice paddies, and they're just not like Japan and South Korea. And it's just that poor of a country. So that was a principal diet. And so what the Chinese fed us was what they found in these villages to feed us. And if there was nothing in the village, you didn't get anything to eat. So he'd escaped and was explaining to me that we're not going to survive with what's going on. And it was true, because we weren't eating enough and walking. They're walking us to death. And the cold, you got to have food to fight off the cold. The conditions of the weather was at the time. So he kept trying to get me to escape with him again, and I said, no, we'll get killed out doing that. We can't do that, not where we're at. I want to try to escape and get back, but I don't want to escape just for food. But after maybe a week, he convinced me that if I didn't escape with him, we're going to starve anyway, you know. So we jumped off one night behind some bombed-out American vehicles that had been destroyed on the side of the road. There were 6x6 trucks and three-quarter tons, and we jumped behind one and squatted down like we had dysentery, like so many of the guys was having at that time, and hopefully that the guard wouldn't see us, and we both stayed there till the rest of the people, the prisoners walked by, and then behind the column always was a Chinaman called, we nicknamed him Geronimo because he had a round, pot-marked face, and he was a killer. And if you get the wounded and sick and the ones that couldn't get up, he'd bend at them or shoot them or anybody left behind when the guns went off. We knew it was him and two or three that were under his direction, followed the column. And once they passed, we got up and started trying to move due west. By looking at the evening star, and we got in box canyons and all night long, clumb in and out, and it was almost an impossible attempt. And by 2 or 3 o'clock the next morning, we'd got out through the mountains in that area, and seen lights, and the whole idea he wanted to do is that it's a single house. It's got to be a single house. Let's go and we'll try to get some food. So we walked around it 2 or 3 times carefully, listening, and it was in the wee hours of the morning, but there was an oil light. They burned bean oil with a little wick in it for lights over there, no electricity. And we looked in the window, and there was a mama son and a papa son in there, and they were having some green tea or something, and they were up, and so we pecked on the window, and I attempted to talk to him in Japanese. I'd learned a lot of the street language when I was stationed in Japan for 25 months, so I attracted the mama son's attention and told her, Gohan arimasu means, have you got any rice? And she said no, but she said what she did have, and I said, watashi tabeto diki do, will you feed me? Will you give me something to eat? And she pointed toward the front door of the place. And so we went around, and it was kind of a corral, because they apparently had an ox, or someone had an ox, because there was a manger out in front. And so we came in through the manger and stood there for about 5 minutes, and the front door opened, and they had a porch on it, kind of like a porch. It was a little better farmhouse, being scattered like it was out on the edge of a village we didn't know was there. And two North Korean soldiers came out. They'd been in there in bed with a couple of North Korean girls, and they come out with long-time rifles. And we were caught cold turkey. We'd escaped and was only gone overnight.
We've got about 2 minutes till we come up to another break, Ken. The second time you escaped, you ended up in a city, and I can't remember the name of it, but you were pretty much left on your own. How did that come about? With the trucker, with the guy who took care of you?
That was Pyongyang. That's the North Korean capital.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about how you ended up there.
Well, I made it all the way to the Yellow Sea.
Oh.
I'd been out maybe 4, 5, 6 weeks. I don't know time. Under those circumstances I was living in, I wasn't concerned so much about time as I was eating food. So I was stealing food and I stole a chicken and a couple of eggs and I found sweet potatoes buried behind some villages where they dig a hole behind these old huts and they make an area like a root cellar. But it's not very deep, but because of how cold it gets over there, but it prolongs the anything they have like that in the cold weather, you know. So I found different things like that and worked my way through to the Yellow Sea over that runs between the peninsula of Korea and China. And there I am, and I was starved. I was just starved. I've been eating, but. And a lot more I would have got on the death march, but I still was starved because of walking through mountains and trying to find my way due west every night, walking by the evening star, you know. Anyway, I seen an old fisherman come in, and I followed him back about a half a mile, a quarter of a mile from the ocean to where there was a single farmhouse. And a young girl left there with a North Korean summer uniform on. Well, she had on padded clothes, I guess. Anyway, but she left. I watched the place for about an hour and a half or 2 hours, and there was only a mama's son and a papa's son. And I went down there, and they fed me. I just walked in the door. And
we're gonna take another break right now, Ken. We're trying to find out. We're talking with Kenneth Eaton, author of Missing Dog Tags, about his adventures as a POW in North Korea. We'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Come on to my house, in my house, I'm gonna give you candy. Come on to my house, in my house, I'm gonna give you figs and dates and grapes and cakes. Come on to my house, my house.
Hi, we're back on Veterans Radio. We're talking with Kenneth Eaton, author of Missing Dog Tags, an American GI in North Korea. And Ken had been captured in 1951 and had escaped a couple of times and is trying to get back to friendly lines, and it just didn't happen. If you want to get in on a conversation, give us a call at 877-573-7825. Ken, you were just talking about your second experience with one of these lonely hooches out in the middle of nowhere. Could you tell us what happened next?
Well, yes, I just opened the door and walked inside, and this mama's son, papa's son scared half to death, but I didn't have a gun, and I started talking to them in Japanese, and the words I could use, and where they could understand me, and I told them that I was hungry and I wanted something to eat, and they had been eating the fish that I'd seen this papa's son bring in when he got out of a little boat about a half a mile away at the Yellow Sea. He'd come in with a double ender and was carrying some small fish, about five or six small ones, and they were eating that and sorghum cane seed, and they even had some Chinese crackers. Well, they're like a hardtack, you know. And I ate one or two of them before, and so whatever. But I ate all I wanted. But the girl that had left apparently had come back real quietly and maybe heard us talking inside. And she had gone for help, and she came back with a couple of Korean soldiers the next morning, and they sprayed the side of the house with a burp gun and a Russian carbine, and were yelling at the old people on the inside, or yelling whatever in North Korean in the Korean language, which I didn't understand real well or at all. And she, mama's son, answered. And all I thought was that she was just trying to get them to stop shooting, but she must have told them I didn't have a gun, because they just opened the door and walked in. And there I'm caught again, you know. So your question was about the Pyongyang, the North Korean capital. Well, ultimately, after they beat the devil out of me and I was forced to dig my own grave there, they was going to kill me, and I talked my way out of it with the language again, you know, the Japanese helping me out. And God, of course, was working for my help for, on my side too. It's got to be. But anyway, after that, and they beat me up real bad. Mama's son almost beat one of my eyes out of my head with a stick, and they busted some ribs on one side. So I was in real bad shape. But they decided not to kill me after I got to talking to them in Japanese, because the Koreans can, almost all of them speak fluent Japanese or a lot of it, because they were occupied for 38 years prior to the Second World War.
Right.
In any case, they ultimately walked me about eight or 10 miles, and then I got in a truck, and they hauled me in a truck to a place about 50 miles north of Pyongyang, the North Korean capital. There's not a lot of roads in Korea, so the main highway is going north and south. I'd been on this road before in our tanks when we were fighting the North Koreans.
Hmm.
But the village was gone, and there was an underground refuge for like a prison, and it was a political prisoner. And then I was put in that and stayed there for a couple of days with another guy that they put me with, another American, and just men and old women, and what they're probably doing over there today, the same thing. Had to maybe 100 or 60 to 100 in this one room, and there were several rooms built underground because of what had been going with our planes. They had to go underground. In any case, ultimately I was taken out of there and hauled by truck to the North Korean capital, which was about 50 miles south of where I was there. And there they put me in me and this fellow with me. His name was Ososki. Well, he died in about 3 days because I couldn't get him to eat good or eat what they gave him, or he'd been captured maybe longer than I don't know, or he hadn't been getting the food I was getting. But in any case, before I met him, they put us in a flat top building with about 30 cells in it, with iron doors across the front, and a corridor out in front of it. But there was no room for us, so the guard made us sleep on the floor, which was fine. But in about 3 days, Ososki was dead. He died during the night, and rigor mortis had set in, and they'd haul him away. Well, this is where I met this Chinese soldier that parked his truck out. The North Korean capital was so bombed, there were just brick walls and vaults and fireplaces standing, and there wasn't many buildings intact. And Pyongyang at that time was probably like San Diego here in America was, you know, in the 40s and 50s. It wasn't really big, you know. It was about like that, except so much of it was bombed out. But there was a lot of people still living in Pyongyang, the North Korean capital. And as soon as the sun got about 5 o'clock, well, the place was just crawling with soldiers and Russians. There were Russians in there. And they had part of their headquarters of controlling the whatever North Koreans were, the army. And supply trucks would hide around these places where they'd park their trucks, and they'd camouflage them. So our planes, because our planes making trips north and south, north and south, fighter planes coming back through, if they had extra ammo, they'd come down and strafe. Mm. While I was there, I was bombed 2 times by B-29s. I lived in the North Korean capital for, I guess, 3 weeks, I'm guessing, 3 or 4 weeks, and then ultimately they took me south. There was a group of about 60 POWs like myself that they had on the far side of the town. I guess they'd stopped them there, walking them south. I don't know why they were taking them south, but they walked them south. So Korean soldiers come and got me and took me from this jailer and walked me about through town to a huge cave on the far side of it with no nothing over the front of the cave, and there was about 60 really terrible looking Americans there. Ragged clothes. They had to be captured as long as I'd been captured. And they put me with them and started walking us that very afternoon at about 5 o'clock out of the town, and we walked south of Pyongyang, the North Korean capital. Like, we thought, well, man, they must be going to turn us loose. And we went to a little town called Sandon down near a river. And where ultimately most of the guys we stayed there, they never fed us. About 16 of us refused to move any further because of the condition we were in, and the North Korean soldiers took the remainder, the healthier ones, and they left us in this town under the care of a couple of about 30-year-old, 25 or 30-year-old North Korean soldiers, and most of these guys start dying. We were in that bad of shape, you know. And I lived there for 5 or 6 days, I think. And a Chinese mule skinner would come over. He came over one time, and he was about 35, 40 years old, and he spoke, of course, Javanese. And when he finally would see us sitting around, we'd ask for begging for food. Anybody to come by, we'd ask for food. And then he wanted to know how long it had been since we'd ate. I'd tell him, I'd hold my hands up and tell him, count in Chinese, or Japanese, either one of them days, and say, Tabaranai, no eat, 8 or 10 days or whatever. And then I would say silit. The word for death is silit in Chinese. And I'd say silit, and I'd point to different rooms. He'd go in and look. One of the dead guys, they were dying, And so 3 days went on, and he come every day. He come down and then he'd go yell at the North Korean soldiers that would let him walk amongst us. And then he'd leave. And the third or fourth day, I don't know which. The third or fourth day, he came with a long-time rifle and took us away. But there was only about 13 of us or something left alive. And he told me to come out, because I'm the one who was talking to him all the time. Told me to come out, and then he pointed north for me to go in that way. And he held a gun on the North Koreans so they couldn't stop us. And those that could walk came out. Those that weren't dead or almost dead came out. And I led, and we walked across a little shallow river, about 100 yards or 150 yards away, and then a slight rise toward a lot of trees another couple of hundred yards away. And it was a Chinese frontline hospital in where they'd taken over a village that was in trees, fairly heavy trees, and a railhead ended in that area. Our planes, I guess, kept the railroad tracks bombed out, but came and ended there in these trees, and they constantly worked on it when our planes had come in and bomb it and rocket it and whatever they do. There'd be 300 South Koreans, laborers out there working on it, getting it back in shape. And what happened in this Chinese frontline hospital was the most severely wounded Chinese were being brought there along the front lines in that area. And they'd amputate legs or whatever was these guys that was surviving. And when a train would come in at night with flat cars, they'd load these horribly wounded Chinese on the flat cars, and the train would leave, of course, going north, so I guess taking them back to China. And there was a place, and supplies would come in that same way,
well,
too.
It sounds like you were very fortunate to end up there. And I've got unfortunately, we've run out of time, Ken, and I want to make sure that our audience knows that this book is available. It's called Missing Dog Tags, An American GI in North Korea. It's available on Amazon. I strongly encourage you to read this. If you don't know anything about the Korean War or about the bravery of some of the American POWs, you've got to read this. Ken Eaton, thank you so very much for being on Veterans Radio. And we're going to have you back to continue this story, because I found it fascinating.
Okay, Dale. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Until next week, you are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.